Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 25. Tonight we will be discussing The Remnant and how it plays a driving role within the Liberty movement. Tonight I am joined by Eric Taylor, Chelsea Cummo, Kirk Pettis, and Lydia Tabbitt. I am Matthew Winter. Eric has a clip that should get a good idea of what The Remnant is, and take it away, Eric.
Sure. So the idea for this podcast, it's been a while coming. Probably a couple of years ago, I came across a clip of Ron Paul referencing The Remnant, and it's a group of individuals who you could say view current events and life events in a bit of a different way. I'm going to pull a quote from Wikipedia that describes it in the Wikipedia wiki article. The Remnant is described as a reoccurring theme throughout the Hebrew and Christian Bible. Dictionary describes it as, quote unquote, what is left of the community after it undergoes a catastrophe. The concept has a stronger representation in the Hebrew rather than the Christian Bible. But it's something that I've observed is kind of a common theme that an individual has that, for whatever reason has become involved in libertarian politics or the liberty movement in general. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about and, kind of get, feedback from the group here and, hopefully kind of expand our understanding and see where it leads to. So I'm going to play a clip from YouTube. It's called, so The Remnant comes from a short story written by Albert J. Nock, who was a writer in the late 1800s and to mid 1900s. And this is actually an audio clip on YouTube that goes over what The Remnant is about. So I'll start the clip. I have the beginning. I didn't get a chance to see when the end of what we're talking about specifically is, but I'll cut it off. And if any of you guys are like, let's jump off this clip, let me know. So I'll play it now.
There is a remnant there that you know nothing about. They are obscure, unorganized, inarticulate, each one rubbing along as best he can. They need to be encouraged and braced up, because when everything has gone completely to the dogs, they are the ones who will come back and build up a new society. And meanwhile, your preaching will reassure them and keep them hanging on. Your job is to take care of the remnant. So be off now and set about it. 2. Apparently, then, if the Lord's word is good for anything, I do not offer any opinion about that. The only element in Judean society that was particularly worth bothering about was the remnant. Isaiah seems finally to have got it through his head that this was the case, that nothing was to be expected from the masses, but that if anything substantial were ever to be done in Judea, the remnant would have to do it. This is a very striking and suggestive idea, but before going on to explore it, we need to be quite clear about the terms. What do we mean by the masses, and what by the remnant? As the word masses is commonly used, it suggests agglomerations of poor and underprivileged people, laboring people, proletarians, and it means nothing like that. It means simply the majority. The mass man is one who has neither the force of intellect to apprehend the principles issuing in what we know as the humane life, nor the force of character to adhere to those principles steadily and strictly as laws of conduct. And because such people make up the great and overwhelming majority of mankind, they are called collectively the masses. The line of differentiation between the masses and the remnant is set invariably by quality, not by circumstance. The remnant are those who by force of intellect are able to apprehend these principles, and by force of character are able, at least measurably, to cleave to them. The masses are those who are unable to do either. The picture which Isaiah presents of the Judean masses is most unfavorable. In his view, the mass man, be he high or be he lowly, rich or poor, prince or pauper, gets off very badly. He appears as not only weak-minded and weak-willed, but as, by consequence, knavish, arrogant, grasping, dissipated, unprincipled, unscrupulous. The mass woman also gets off badly, as sharing all the mass man's untoward qualities and contributing a few of her own in the way of vanity and laziness, extravagance and foible. The list of luxury products that she patronized is interesting. It calls to mind the woman's page of a Sunday newspaper in 1928 or the display set forth in one of our professedly smart periodicals. In another place, Isaiah even recalls the affectations that we used to know by the name Flappergate and the debutante slouch. It may be fair to discount Isaiah's vivacity a little for prophetic fervor. After all, since his real job was not to convert the masses, but to brace and reassure the remnant, he probably felt that he might lay it on indiscriminately and as thick as he liked. In fact, that he was expected to do so. But even so, the Judean mass man must have been a most objectionable individual, and the mass woman utterly odious. If the modern spirit, whatever that may be, is disinclined towards taking the Lord's word at its face value, as I hear is the case, we may observe that Isaiah's testimony to the character of the masses has strong collateral support from respectable Gentile authority. Plato lived into the administration of Eubulus, when Athens was at the peak of its jazz and paper era, and he speaks of the Athenian masses with all Isaiah's fervency, even comparing them to a herd of ravenous wild beasts. Curiously, too, he applies Isaiah's own word remnant to the worthier portion of Athenian society. There is but a very small remnant, he says, of those who possess a saving force of intellect and force of character, too small, preciously as to Judea, to be of any avail against the ignorant and vicious preponderance of the masses. But Isaiah was a preacher and Plato a philosopher, and we tend to regard preachers and philosophers rather as passive observers of the drama of life than as active participants. Hence, in a matter of this kind, their judgment might be suspected of being a little uncompromising, a little acrid, or, as the French say, sal granou. We may therefore bring forward another witness who was preeminently a man of affairs and whose judgment cannot lie under this suspicion. Marcus Aurelius was ruler of the greatest of empires, and in that capacity he not only had the Roman mass man under observation, but he had him on his hands 24 hours a day for 18 years. What he did not know about him was not worth knowing, and what he thought of him is abundantly attested on almost every page of the little book of jottings which he scribbled offhand from day to day, and which he meant for no eye but his own ever to see. This view of the masses is the one that we find prevailing at large among the ancient authorities whose writings have come down to us. In the 18th century, however, certain European philosophers spread the notion that the mass man, in his natural state, is not at all the kind of person that earlier authorities made him out to be, but on the contrary, that he is a worthy object of interest. His untowardness is the effect of environment, an effect for which society is somehow responsible. If only his environment permitted him to live according to his lights, he would undoubtedly show himself to be quite a fellow, and the best way to secure a more favorable environment for him would be to let him arrange it for himself. The French Revolution acted powerfully as a springboard for this idea, projecting its influence in all directions throughout Europe. On this side of the ocean, a whole new continent stood ready for a large-scale experiment with this theory. It afforded every conceivable resource whereby the masses might develop a civilization made in their own likeness and after their own image. There was no force of tradition to disturb them in their preponderance or to check them in the thoroughgoing disparagement of the remnant. Immense natural wealth, unquestioned predominance, virtual isolation, freedom from external interference and the fear of it, and finally, a century and a half of time. Such are the advantages which the mass man has had in bringing forth a civilization which should set the earlier preachers and philosophers at naught in their belief that nothing substantial can be expected from the masses, but only from the remnant. His success is unimpressive. On the evidence so far presented, one must say, I think, that the mass man's conception of what life has to offer and his choice of what to ask from life seem now to be pretty well what they were in the times of Isaiah and Plato. And so, too, seem the catastrophic social conflicts and convulsions in which his views of life and his demands on life involve him. I do not wish to dwell on this, however, but merely to observe that the monstrously inflated importance of the masses has apparently put all thought of a possible mission to the remnant out of the modern prophet's head. This is obviously quite as it should be, provided that the earlier preachers and philosophers were actually wrong.
So this gives you, I could continue to go on, it gives you a good idea. So the remnant that Ron Paul and Albert J. Nock reference are a small group of individuals who are aware, unbiased group of individuals who are aware of what's going on. So that you'd classify them as being out of the mainstream. They utilize critical thinking. They don't go with the popular trends or don't utilize politics to gain for themselves, but they're concerned about society as a whole. So that's really why I thought, and we can continue to listen to this clip if you guys want to or not. It doesn't, either way is fine. But that's what I found interesting. I have a clip by Ron Paul as well that he kind of references. It's at a John Birch Society meeting, which was about 15, 16 years ago. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I thought that it's important to note, as far as, you know, the remnant goes, that I don't know if you guys have noticed this trend, but the more that I talk to people, the more that I will find people who kind of have their eyes opening more and more as time goes on. I feel like maybe that starts to happen when you have an economic downturn or less than favorable conditions, that people start paying more attention and wake up to what's happening, as opposed to just living with the status quo and being happy in their own wealth and their own situation. But I'm finding the more that I talk to people, the more I uncover remnants among us. Have you found that? Any of you guys found that as well?
Most definitely. I think it's self-evident by the amount of people that end up voting on election days, that the numbers keep falling. And like Eric said, how some people phrase the remnant as well as people that don't believe in either of the parties, that if you think that you are going to gain freedom by voting for either the Democrats or the Republicans or the establishment per se, that you are not part of the remnant. You are a part of the establishment then, and part of the masses that just don't see the truth behind, don't understand the principles of freedom and liberty. And, and like you said, saying, Chelsea, I think a lot of people are just waking to this whole two-party system that don't really, they've always believed on one side or the other that this is what's wrong, the other side's wrong, or, you know, my side's right. And as they mature and see enough elections and see enough of the hoopla and the shakedown of politics, then they awaken to the fact that it really doesn't matter. And the principles of freedom are kind of the essential thing, in that it's progressed so far. Like, and that's how Ron Paul says it, that it's, he was never intending to win. He was more like Isaiah, where he just wanted to strengthen the remnant and portray the ideas and to strengthen the people in the remnant to know that they are right and that they're not the only ones that see the problems, and to know there's others out there that are like-minded, and that, you know, the collapse of the dollar is going to happen anyways, and our lifestyle is going to drastically change someday, and hopefully the remnant will be there to build back up a society, essentially.
Yeah, and I, from what I've observed, it seems, you know, as far as the liberty movement's concerned, you know, good ideas don't necessarily take root at any given time. You have to have a multitude of scenarios that fall in place to allow for a technology or a good idea to take root. And when you're talking about libertarianism, the individuals who participate in the movement are very aware of what's going on in society, but they're scattered about. It's a small percentage. But with the advent of the internet and everyone being connected, this group can now communicate and impact conversations and change at a much higher level. And it's really, you know, I think that's what you saw in 2008, 2012. A disproportionately low amount of participants were really able to influence the conversation, and more and more and more, especially amongst the millennials, are having a significant impact on and how people are viewing society and the political environment in general.
And one thing that I thought was interesting when I was reading one of these articles was the differentiation between the establishment and the remnant, because it's sort of, you know, two categories. A lot of people tend, and what I tended to believe that the establishment meant was the actual government or the people in power, whether they're an elite group of people that have, you know, power to influence the government or the government itself. But this article was sort of going into more depth to understand that the establishment includes not just the, you know, political parties or the government branches or, you know, this elite group of people, but it can also include and does include all of the everyday citizens that support it in one way or another. So the people that believe that a certain political party will fix our problems is part of the establishment, or the people that think that the way to make it better is through government intervention is part of the establishment, or the people that believe, you know, the news, you know, or they watch the news believing that they're getting an unbiased opinion of the activities in the world or the current state in affairs. All of these people that cling to this two-party system are also involved when we talk about the establishment, because they further the establishment's goals. And the biggest difference with the remnant is to say, you know, it's not about the Republicans and it's not about the Democrats. They're both part of the establishment itself, and they both further the establishment's goals of, you know, increasing their power and minimizing the power of the people. And that the remnant believes that the real change has to come from the people themselves. And I recently had a discussion with someone who was disgruntled by, he had gone to a for-profit university, and he was disgruntled with the amount of his student loan payments as opposed to the value that he felt that he took away from it. And I said to him, look, you know, there are going to be companies out there, for-profit or non-profit, that are going to, you know, try and take advantage of you. Any salesperson is incentivized to make the sale, and you can't just necessarily think, oh, well, this person seems very nice, so therefore I should trust them. No, it's up to you as an individual to do your due diligence and to do your research and to protect yourself and make the best decisions for yourself that you possibly can. You know, you shouldn't jump to the conclusion that all for-profit schools are evil or all such and such companies are evil. I mean, you have to take some individual responsibility for the choices that you're making and say, okay, well, I decided to go get my degree in massage therapy and I paid $100,000 for it. If I'm going to go make a $100,000 purchase, I'm going to do the research ahead of time and say, is this going to be a good financial decision for me? Is this going to be a good life decision for me? And then I'm going to read the contract. And if I don't, that's once again on me. And I wouldn't, you know, then blame someone or something else and say, well, the government has to step in because this was unfair and I'm a victim. And trying to talk to people and say, look, it's up to us to protect ourselves, to govern ourselves, and to make good decisions for our own lives. And the second that we relinquish that and say, well, no, I just believed this salesperson, and so I'm a victim now, and therefore the government should step in. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa. What happened to individual responsibility? You knew. I mean, it took was a Google search to say, how much does an average, you know, massage therapist make upon completion of their degree? How much are my student loan payments going to be if I take out $100,000? You know, just taking these simple steps could have prevented what he found to be an unfavorable position, but the culture is such that we tend to blame someone else. And when it comes to the remnant, the same thing can, you know, be said of, you know, the way that the government is or how much power and corruption we see with the government itself. All of it has to come down to us deciding that this is not acceptable, and, you know, and working together to do something about it and to take responsibility for it instead of just blaming this party or that party for all the problems of the world.
Yeah, in regards to, you know, kind of that debate, the for-profit or, you know, public or private university system, you know, these schools are all incentivized to enroll students. You know, in my mind, a huge problem with that system is how for-profit financial institutions give out loans for whatever program so easily. And you know, students, you know, if they go to Dunwoody or Crown College or whatever, you know, for-profit colleges, you know, they qualify for these loans and they may not be going in, you know, more liberal arts areas, may not be going in areas that have a lot of demand for qualified candidates. And they, you know, a lot of time, when people are younger, they just don't take the whole situation, you know, as how it is, and they make poor decisions, and they're kind of victimized. And they, you know, a lot of people who argue that they kind of play the victim card. So they're, you know, in some ways, in my mind, these financial companies, there needs to be, I don't know if it needs to be necessary, you know, obviously we here believe in, you know, the least amount of government is the best type of government, but there are predatory lending agencies that take advantage of these people.
And I wouldn't disagree that people aren't taken advantage of, but I mean, I think that in all areas of life, we are, if we don't arm ourselves with, you know, good decision making, or if we don't arm ourselves with, you know, knowledge, then we're going to be left vulnerable for our entire lives to become victimized over and over again, because
you can't count on somebody else to do it for you.
Yeah, you can, you know, and if you go and you sign a contract, or if you go and, you know, purchase something for $100,000, I mean, if you go buy a house without having it inspected first, I mean, you're putting yourself in the position to be victimized repeatedly. So, I mean, it would be one thing if you said, you know, I was 18 years old, I didn't have a family or a support system to help me through the process, and I was young and I was naive, and I was put in this bad situation. I mean, I tend to believe at 18 years old, you don't have a whole lot of, you know, experience or knowledge to be able to make some of these really important decisions. And I think that you are kind of vulnerable still at 18 years of age.
Yeah, for sure.
But at the same time, you know, if somebody does this when they're 30, I feel a lot less bad about it, because I believe that, you know, if you want to be a victim for the rest of your life, by all means, just believe whatever any salesman is going to tell you. But, I mean, then I just don't feel sorry for it. I mean, I think that what we have to do is start telling people, look, take it seriously. Think about your decisions. You know, don't trust the salesman. They're, you know, think about who, you know, the incentives of who is telling you the story. So if I ask the, you know, so I just got rear-ended recently, and so I'm hearing from the insurance company, well, we could total it. We want to total it out. And then I ask the, you know, the car auto repair shop. They say, oh, well, the damage isn't that bad. We could fix it. I have to know, you know, the incentives of the insurance company, and then I have to kind of understand the incentives of the dealership and take those both with a grain of salt, and then go a step further and do research. Would it be in my best interest to total out the car and take the cash, or would it be in my best interest to actually get it fixed? You know, but knowing that the auto repair shop is incentivized to get it fixed, because then they have the job and then they're going to make some money, versus, you know, thinking that they're just telling me this as my buddy and in my best interest.
Yeah, this kind of goes into what we're talking about, though, that we get into the arguments of, you know, making better choices, or, you know, or the argument of, well, we should have government involved. How about if we look at it that this is the results of the system that has been created around us, that because of the cheap money, the Federal Reserve, our dollar, how we, that who would, in their right mind, what business would go out there and loan $100,000 to someone that's going to just get a massage degree, massage therapy, or some other degree that's going to be difficult to pay off that much money, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. So it's because of the cheap money practices of our government and the policies created around there is what creates this ease of going into a degree that, you know, that the ease of making wrong decisions in the long term for a more profitable, sustainable society. And that, do you see what I'm saying? It's so the principles. I mean, but we also talk about the remnant, to where, you know, it's where you have the principles, you know that there's something wrong with the situation, and at the same time, almost all jobs today have to be licensed through the state. So at the same time,
that's exactly what I was gonna say.
You're feeding the beast by going into these jobs that you have to get licensed. You have to, that it goes into the program. That is self-serving, that, oh, well, I know this is wrong, but I can't change because I'm reliant on this job now. And it just becomes a self-serving down the establishment, down the mass growing government stage that we live on in this world. And that's why it's just a crumbling system that's crumbling upon itself, that it's too late, as Ron Paul has said himself, that to get enough people in enough time to go and change the system. That it's better to just focus on ourselves, get the education, get more self-reliant, you know, have sound money, hopefully land that we won't be confiscated from us when these large crises happen. And it's these kind of things that really sparked the Ron Paul movement to get people actually activated into the Republican Party, that, as we have all witnessed through this last year, going through the delegate method way, that, you know, all the people have kind of just fizzled out. And that's just how the remnant is. You know, they just know that it's not part of the political system, that you can't change it within. You can't go and get licensed in a way and then try and change the licensing factor, because it's, I don't know, making any sense in what I'm saying?
Right. And I remember that we had a conversation some months ago about, you know, how do we best spread, grow, and enhance liberty, you know, in the United States. And I know that from a practical standpoint, there are many advocates of saying, well, it would be unrealistic for someone independent of either of the major political parties to have any chance of creating significant change. But when we talk about the remnant, one of the main points is to say we can't rely on the government to create real change. Real change only comes from the choices of, you know, regular people. You know, it comes from us as individuals and the way that we choose to live our lives. And part of the ethos behind that being that the government is a reflection of the people themselves and our beliefs. Because to a certain extent, they have to rally support in one way or another. And one easy way that they've been able to do that is to find, you know, certain things that people are really passionate about, like gay marriage or abortion, and then to, you know, pit these people against each other that are on opposite sides, and then move forward with regulations and increased authority and, you know, an increased power over the way that we live our lives. As opposed to us as a people saying, you know, we are a country made of people with vast differences in our belief systems, vast differences in our ideals and our moralities and our religions. And for us to live together under one country, we have to allow for those differences to exist and we have to accept that those differences exist in order for us to live our own lives. And if we can't accept that there are people out there with differences that might go against the very core of what we believe, we still have to respect the fact that they have the right to live their lives just as we have the right to live ours. And the second that we ask the government to intervene and make, you know, a dictation as to what we believe is correct, the second we open up the doors for them to outlaw things that are part of what we believe is okay. Instead, we have to say we need to let ourselves govern ourselves and let other people govern themselves, so long as they're not, you know, interfering with my life. But we have to, instead of speaking to the government, I think that we need to be speaking to the people themselves and taking them and hopefully inspiring them to remove themselves from the establishment and to join the remnant.
Well, I don't think it's just talking to others, too. It's talking to ourselves, that freedom is easy to say you believe in liberty and the like, but it's a lifelong struggle, like we were just talking about. It's once you just get bugged at something, it's so easy to cry for others to do, you know, that this is wrong, there needs to be laws or something or such around it, that freedom needs to be practiced, to be rehearsed, and only you can do that yourself. So it's something that constantly have in your back of your mind to reflect upon, because we're all going to stumble and trip along the way of life. And and the more reading you do on it, the more you study, and the more life you live throughout it with the attitude of self-consciousness and self-realization, and to admit that you are going to be wrong a lot of times, even though you think you believe in liberty and freedom, that it's a lifelong goal, and it's a lifelong journey to embark upon, is what I think.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about the remnant versus the majority, which was touched upon in the clip I played, it's been an issue throughout modern civilization. You have, you could argue that to a certain extent, the founding fathers of the United States were part of that group. And, other modern civilization, free and open civilizations have had these individuals who have been informed and concerned and non-objective about society. But the problem is that you have a majority that is pretty malleable in most cases, most contexts that exists within every society. And so, it's kind of a constant struggle. And I apologize, my phone is ringing. that's there.
And common sense is calling, Eric. Common sense.
Evidently. Yeah. So that, it's an issue. It's an issue that's been there, since there's been people on the planet, and, probably will be the case for quite a bit into the future.
Well, and I think something that's kind of that I've observed is that a lot of people within the what we would call, I guess, the liberty movement largely I notice a lot of people in the liberty movement really have a difficult time of communicating or persuading, I guess, others of kind of the liberty movement message, just because I think, as you were saying, Eric, there's a certain malleability that the majority of people in the liberty movement either don't understand or are opposed to sort of taking advantage of or something. Do you see what I'm saying?
Not completely. Are you saying they don't understand marketing?
We're kind of off-putting at times. It's so easy to say that, to take the higher road and be like, well, our idea is right because we're based on freedom and liberty, and it's off-putting to people. And the thing is over the long-term, people do reflect upon that long-term. They will get mad at you at first, but over time, they start to self-realize. So it goes back to the first clip about the prophet Isaiah. Eric clipped it out, but when he was talking with God, God told him that he wasn't going to do him any good. And so Isaiah was like, well, why should I even embark upon this call that you're calling me for? And it's just because, to go out there and just to put that in people's minds, and over time it helps, and then it strengthens the people along that do believe it already.
So, Lydia, was your thought that this is more in the context of marketing, that, a lot of people within the liberty movement just don't know how to pitch the message?
Maybe not specifically, but persuading. Persuading, yeah. I think there's a difficulty among those in the liberty movement at large that struggle with either understanding how the more malleable people think, or maybe they do understand it and
really breaking up Lydia right now.
You're breaking up a lot right now, Lydia.
Really? Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, I'll repeat what I said. Is that better?
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. So, I don't know. Something I've observed is sort of within the liberty movement at large is, a tendency to not understand those that are more, I guess, what we would consider malleable, just kind of a lack of understanding of how those people think and how to communicate with them or persuade them. In some instances, maybe there's an understanding of how those people think and a knowledge of how to persuade them of, the liberty-oriented ideas, but sort of persuading those people using non like argument based, I guess, means is sort of off putting to someone. That's just something I've noticed.
Well, yeah, are people really
there are individuals who they have the litmus test stuff, and they, if you don't completely agree with me, you're a moron, and they come off as almost know-it-alls, which, I think that's what you're referencing, right, Lydia? It can be kind of off-putting to, people who might be receptive, but, if you get verbally beaten
well,
over the head.
Where I'm coming from on this is that there are a lot of people in the liberty movement are really into ideas and philosophy and really sinking their teeth into like the content of like different ideas and issues and philosophies. And when you talk to, your average mainstream person, who I would say falls into the more malleable, persuadable, camp, they don't necessarily think that way. They're a little bit, in many cases, maybe more superficial or, single issue minded. And I think there's people in the liberty movement that either don't understand that viewpoint or that way of thinking, or if they do, the probably most effective, I guess, political per se means of advancing their own beliefs would be like taking advantage of that or something. Does that make sense?
Right.
I think instead of calling them malleable, I think that what I tend to find is that people become so set in their own beliefs because they've believed them for so long, or they've so passionately adhered to a specific topic or ideology that's, thrown into the basket of one political party or another, that you encounter a lot of difficulty in someone walking away from that because of the way that it's structured. Not only is it, well, I want to vote for this party or another, but they bring it inside themselves, and it then becomes a part of their identity. Who are you? I'm a Democrat. I'm a Republican. This is who I am as a person. And the second that somebody says, this is who I am, and they internalize it in that form, it becomes a matter of, pride and regret and all these other emotional components that go with the idea of having to change that, So if I say, I'm an honest person, or if I say, I'm an artist, to then later say, maybe I'm not an artist, takes every single time that I said I was an artist. Now, does that make me a liar, or does that make me stupid or foolish? And then they're all, it's sort of like when you talk about Porter's five forces in business of competition, one of them, one of the forces that they talk about is the cost, the switching cost. So one thing that deters people from going from, buying one product versus the competitor is how expensive is it for me to switch from one to the other? So how expensive is it for me to change my internet provider? Well, I think it can be very emotionally expensive for people to change their political identity that they've, you know, manifested within themselves in terms of identifying, you know, with one party versus another and saying, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat and this is who I am. And then to be able to, you know, to have to go to all their friends and family who they've made attestations or representations for years and years and years to say, I'm a Democrat, to suddenly say, well, actually, I realize I'm not a Democrat. I believe in liberty and I believe in, you know, self-reliance and I believe in a small, you know, smaller government. And to switch from one to the other to say, well, I thought I was a Republican, but it turns out that wasn't true, I think can be, you know, there can be a high emotional cost for people. And whether or not they're, you know, realizing that's the reason why they're so resistant, a lot of times that's what makes it so effective is because these things are all very unconscious. It's, you know, when it comes to the emotional level, it's not like people are thinking about it rationally and going like, I know that this is maybe what represents me more, but I don't want to do it because of this X or Y. Instead, you know, it's those, that emotional and the less rational part of themselves that they maybe can't even articulate to someone or they're not, thinking about in a full sentence structure. It's just that emotional resistance that maybe they can't even verbalize or put their finger on, but they just are immediately, hesitant to switch. Does that, I mean, have you guys found that to be true when you speak to people that align themselves with one of the two mainstream political parties?
No, I think that's
Actually, that's a, oh, I was going to say, that's a good point, Chelsea. I think maybe the terms rational and irrational would maybe fit better than malleable and, right. and non-malleable. That was a good point.
Yeah, I
completely agree. I think there's a certain part of the population that just doesn't care either.
Which, you know, they just want to live.
Yeah, pretty much. Leave me alone. I don't want to deal with it.
Which in the context of Isaiah's job would be classified as the majority, right? So the individuals who are into party politics identification, who may or may not even care to understand, you know, the process in any way, that's probably the majority of people.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, with phrases like "he who dies with the most toys wins," you know, that's kind of just goes in there. I don't think that those kind of people aren't going to worry about politics at all. It's just be on top, do whatever the most you can in life, and go from there. And I, to me, the one thing that I think we're really missing too, on top of the politics and talking about how people are so stuck on either side and it's hard for them to think otherwise, it really goes back into licensing and unions and the type of work you do. And it just becomes a part of the system that really is self-reliant on the system then, and it just grows from there on and it creates more and more government control and more and less individual control, to where it becomes easier just to get licensed and let the people that control the licensing and that organization to deal with all that little stuff instead of you having to go do it and be more of a self-entrepreneur in a sense. But
well, you know, on top of, you know, the licensing itself, they've actually done studies that show and this isn't true of everyone, but there have been trends that show that, you know, when people are in more blue-collar jobs, that they tend to vote Democrat more so, or if they're in, you know, union jobs, they tend to vote Democrat, like a lot of teachers will vote Democrat. But then as people start making more money, they start swinging to the right. So maybe as they get older, they might start voting Republican, and you know, or as they start, you know, if somebody gets a job where suddenly they're making, you know, $200,000 a year, that they might be more inclined to vote Republican. And so some of this is that natural human condition to protect yourself and to protect your own interests. And so, you know, we will see that people will vote, you know, partly based on principle, but then also partly on what is going to benefit them as an individual the most. I mean, if they're not making very much money, or if they find themselves frequently on welfare, or if they're someone who finds themselves frequently paying a very high tax bill, they're going to vote for the political party that is going to benefit them as an individual, as opposed to, you know, making a voting decision that is best for the country. You know, they're going to protect their own self-interest.
Well, excellent. I think most of that derives from an early education, and it's just so much easier to teach upon government doing enacting those things. And it might just be a side aspect that, because you start making more money as you get older inside the same profession. And so that it might not just be that the fact that you make more money and it's more self-interest to you, it's just you actually have lived long enough and seen the process that you've gone through that it really doesn't help like they've always promised it would. And that the government really doesn't really help. All it does is take, and it creates this forcing mechanism that's self-serving upon itself, and that people just, I think, over time awaken to it, and then they get hoodwinked and maybe switch into the Republican Party thinking that, well, I was wrong here, maybe the other party must be right. And I think over time a lot of people find that, neither was right.
But I think that's an interesting point, Chelsea. Survival instinct plays a dominant role in any decision-making process, right? So you could apply that to many different contexts. Now, we're talking about, you know, specifically politics here, but if you're making less money and you see, you know, pulling the lever one way will benefit you more than the other way, then you're going to do that. If you're making more, pulling it the other way will be more beneficial to yourself. And, you know, in the context of any society, the majority makes less, and they're going to vote to protect themselves, as self-preservation, essentially, right?
Yep.
I think that's part of the biggest fallacy of having a two-party system, is that it sustains itself just by pitting people against each other. Instead of people looking at what the potential alternatives would be, you pit people against in high emotional topics such as abortion or welfare and things of that nature, instead of looking at the overall better welfare of society. So that way you can polarize people and take pretty much non-issues and create topics that make people vote instead of having to tackle the real problems that society has, such as the national debt ceiling, Federal Reserve, real problems.
Absolutely. And one thing that I always thought was interesting about, and I'm sorry if I've mentioned this story before, but when people look at the media, they'll look at, you know, the news stories that they tell and then, you know, the specific slant, or if they perceive there's a lack of slant, and say, well, these guys tell the truth or whatever. But they don't necessarily look at what stories are these people choosing to talk about. And that has a much greater influence on our thoughts and our opinions and our feelings than how they portray the story itself. And the same thing can be said for the political scene. It's not just about what slant are they taking on this particular topic, but what topics are they even having a discussion about? You know, what things are they discussing versus what aren't they discussing? And that's what we tend to do a fairly poor job of, is saying, what aren't we talking about that we should be talking about? What are topics that are very important that aren't even being discussed? You know, so it's not just how do I feel about abortion, or how do I feel about gay marriage, or how do I feel about welfare. What are the things that we should be talking about for the greater good of society that aren't even being brought to the table?
I think that's an excellent point. And I'd like to I'm gonna play another clip. This is a Ron Paul clip. Speaking on the Remnant, and we can discuss and probably wrap up within the next 10 minutes or so. I'll roll this clip.
I'd like to close with a little summary of the story that Albert J. Nock wrote about, called Isaiah's Job. Isaiah, of course, from the Old Testament, was a prophet that was obedient to God. And he lived about 750 B.C., and it was after 50 years of great prosperity. And Isaiah was told that bad times were coming. His job was to go out and warn the people of bad times coming. And he said he would. He was a little bit reluctant and argued a bit. And but then God warned him. He said, you could go out and you do it, and I want you to do it, but I want you to remember one thing. It's not going to make a lot of difference. They're not going to listen to you, and there's still going to be a crisis. The government won't listen to you. And he said, why should I do it? Said, God says, because the people will listen. There will be a remnant. There will be a remnant out there. And that remnant is very important, obviously, to all of us. So he says, and the Lord says, the Lord said, you do not get the point. There is a remnant there that you know nothing about. They are obscure, unorganized, inarticulate, each one rubbing along as best he can. They need to be encouraged and braced up, because when everything has gone completely to the dogs, they are the ones who will come back and build up a new society. And meanwhile, your preaching will reassure them and keep them hanging on. Your job is to take care of the remnant. So be off now and set about it. That's what our job is about. Be off and set about it. The Birch Society has been doing this for a long time now, way ahead of everybody else. And they've received a lot of criticism. Quite frankly, I have no idea what will happen to the Birch Society. Hopefully it'll be 10 times bigger in 2 years, but who knows. But I do know the message of the Birch Society is ringing loud and clear, louder and clearer than it ever has before.
And the rest is Birch Society preaching. But, you know, it's essentially the same verbiage that was behind the clip that I threw up initially, and I think that's true. And I personally am encouraged by people I've seen, you know, involved in the liberty movement, and maybe like you're saying, Kirk, they've dropped off within the last year and a half. But I think they represent more than a small minority, especially as you get into the millennial area. I think that message is going to continue, and you know, in a couple of years, once we see Rand Paul run, we'll see a lot of individuals who may have, you know, been a bit disgruntled and probably more continued to participate, and you know, hopefully these people will be there, because they're, you know, in all likelihood there are always issues and crises that come about. Hopefully we'll have enough people in place to really put in place a good solution, a better solution than what we have now.
Yeah. I'm just wondering what happened to the conversation we were having 2 years ago of this financial crisis, this, you know, the dollar so weakened and this imminent crisis that's happening. I mean, that's kind of fallen off the lips of most liberty people in a way, because Federal Reserve has patched things up, you know, for the last few years. But there are these worldwide trends that are really showing the ugly head of how this is, the collapse is getting stronger and stronger. And it's not being talked about. Do you think it's going to come up again in 2 years when, you know, maybe Rand Paul's running? Or, you know, it's – I kind of feel like a lot of us have let our guard down about this whole topic, and it's not really discussed anymore about because to me, the money policy is the main aspect of most of it. But
yeah, and I think I had to a large degree – the Federal Reserve has, and the European Union, and the Central Bank of China have printed a significant amount of money. They're battling a deflationary situation. So essentially, we're in a stagflation or disinflation period, where the primary concern with the central banks is deflation. And in my mind, deflation is a positive thing. But as far as central bankers are concerned, that's not the case. So, economies have recovered to a certain extent. Markets have significantly recovered in the last 5 years. So people who are invested in...
Yeah, but it's all on fake money.
But
the money doesn't exist.
Yeah, but that money exists when you sell a stock and you decide to buy a home or whatever. It certainly exists. So,
yes, but it's going to come to a head just because the world is starting to realize that our American dollar doesn't have anything behind it.
Right, but now that... So there's a certain, amongst people who can participate
about my point, though, is, that the stock market is up so high that no one talks about it anymore.
Well, most people don't
because of the 2008 crisis that, it was easy to talk about because things were looking bleak. But it's really right now we're even a bigger bubble than we were then. And it's going to burst soon. And it's going to be talked about again. Why not talk about it now and get out in front of it?
I don't think you and a lot of people who think that the economy is going to crash really don't take into account technology and innovation and how it's impacting the ability to produce more products in almost every arena, which is benefiting society as a whole. And
there's a
information
cost to it.
Technology revolution that over the last 10 years has really taken root, and that's affected agriculture, the ability to produce goods and services and that type of thing that is a long-term phenomenon. So you kind of have, and I've noticed this in the liberty movement, people saying that everything's going to go to the dogs, but I don't think that's happening, and it's going to happen.
Give you a few little stats. I mean, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, it was because they had around 3% of assets, for how the fractional reserve banking system works. And the Federal Reserve now is down to it's well under 2% assets now. And the world, through the BRIC countries like Russia, China, Brazil, they're starting to diverge themselves away from the American dollar and starting to trade in their own currencies. And once the petrodollar collapses, American dollar is going to just be shredded. The only reason why we live such a high lifestyle in America and why the stock market's up and our goods and services that we utilize is because of the goodwill of the world to trade in our American dollar. And they're waking up to the fact because of technology that they don't need to do that anymore. And it's once that people start exiting the door, it's going to just all of a sudden just more and more people are going to be like, well, why the hell am I here? Then it's going to be a mass exodus all of a sudden one day. And
I disagree with that.
Yeah, I do too.
I think there's when it comes down to it, biblically, wealth of the nation is in the land, and we have the best food production in the world right now. And when it all comes down to it, the biggest thing that people are going to be concerned about is feeding themselves. So,
that goes to what Eric's talking about is technology.
Well, it's not
only the technology today to produce our own food without any tractors, without the manual labor that we needed to do 100 years ago, pre-industrial, 200 years ago, pre-industrial revolution.
You still need the nutrients and you still need the land to do it. And I understand that there's different aquaponics and other technologies that are coming out, but those are in such infancy that in our lifetime, we're not going to see a situation where the food supply is going to become a non-factor.
Well, this is just going to lead us into one of our future topics about new sovereign nations.
Absolutely.
Well, and the new technology that they are utilizing and that is buried technology that really does exist, and because of the system we live in, is suppressed technology that is out there that contains the seeds of our own success in a minute landscape area that we can become our own nations and self-reliant. And the future is great for technology, but with this more and more system of people relying on this federal petrodollar and the system that's created around it, once this starts to erode, things are going to change dramatically, and it's hopefully the remnants there to bring it back. But there are going to be other methods. But I just think that if it was so relevant 2 years ago when we were all running for Rand Paul, then why isn't it relevant today? I mean, it kind of just goes into that system. Well, all right, the Fed is correct. You know, maybe we were wrong 2 years ago, and I don't believe that is true in any sense.
No, I don't disagree with you here, but I have a jingle for you, Kirk.
Nailed it.
What are you going to say, Lydia?
I don't remember.
Sorry,
I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, there is... You know, that seems to be a conversation that is strong within liberty circles, is that everything's going to end in, a fiery ball of
It's what is going to replace it. Are we going to have a dictatorship or more of a freedom respecting government that evolves around it?
Right.
And yeah. So that is where the remnant is so important, to be able to develop that freedom-loving, liberty-loving respect for a strong sense of liberty law, not a government of positive law, of regulation and licensing and such a control-down sphere, a dictatorship, to say it, or more of a... It won't even be, it'll just be a conglomerate of dictatorship, fascism, socialism all at the same time, but.
Love me a little Miles Davis.
I mean, yeah, but I don't think, according to Ron Paul that we all loved, listen to and highly respect, he claims that, you know, what I was saying, that it's only a matter of time that dollar's gonna fade away. What will be left behind then, and definitely that is why the remnant is so important.
Yeah, the dollar conversation is gonna, and I think I agree with your points, Kirk. The petrodollar is one of the primary reasons why you see conflict in the Middle East, right?
Yes,
really.
Because Nixon is the one that made the deal with Saudi Arabia to just trade in the petrodollar.
Yeah.
And that happened because the dollar was getting so weak. But why would Saudi Arabia agree to this? Our dollar is being... All they do is take our dollar and turn around and buy our treasury bonds, which doesn't even hold its value to inflation. So what interest does Saudi Arabia have to do that, other than we're just propping up that dictatorial regime over there? That's the only reason. And so our actions of creating this dollar that's getting so inflated, so fake, so fiat, it's wrecking havoc in the world, and that's why it's doomed to fail eventually. And the only reason Saudi Arabia, I mean, they're losing money essentially, but it's propping up their power. And that's the only true reason why they do such a thing.
That's a topic for another day. But at the end of the day, what we do have to say is that if there is a downturn, and even if there isn't, who we have to rely on and who we have to seek comfort and support and responsibility from is the people themselves and not our government. So we have to look to each other to make good decisions for our own lives and live our lives full of liberty and respect for each other's rights instead of through governmental means.
Well,
you know what? I think that was probably the best wrapping up statement I've ever heard on this podcast. With that, I'm going to say, everybody, thank you for joining us. This has been Liberty Southwest, podcast number 25.
Good night.
Have a good night.
Good night.